funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
What kind of music will you like? Computer algorithms are good at serving up more of what we found in the past, but could it be that the same loud intensity that draws you into Hank Williams singing Your Cheating Heart will also get you into Sia belting Titanium? Top that one, Pandora. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Ben Ratliff makes his living listening to music and writing about it for the New York Times. That sounds like a dream job, but it also requires Ratliff to constantly expand the range of his tastes. His job doesn't allow him to get stuck exclusively on the music he first fell in love with, and he says the rest of us would do well to keep pushing ourselves into new areas of discovery. He writes about how we can find and appreciate music we never knew we'd like in his new book, Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. Ben, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
It would seem like the greatest thing ever. It is great that we can instantly listen to just about anything we want to, but then that lack of limits can be a little paralyzing.
Well, yeah, that's true. Although, you know, I wonder about that a little bit. I feel like the conversation that we're all having lately about music is, there's just so much out there. I don't know what to do. I need help. I guess I don't really feel that way. I feel very positive about how much is out there. It feels like a good thing. But my feeling is that the streaming services would like you to feel paralyzed. Because then they have a role. You know, then they can say, look, just leave it to us. We'll take care of it. We can figure out what you like and basically who you are and what kind of listener you are. And we will serve it up for you. And we will promise discovery, but it'll be a kind of discovery that is sort of acceptable to you.
And you talk about the idea of music that has been kept from us. It's not like people are deliberately not wanting us to hear something, but lots of people have a vested interest in making us listen to something that they have to sell.
Well, okay. I mean, I do. The funny thing about this book is that I don't really talk about platforms all that much in this book. You know, it's really 20 essays about listening experiences. That you can have. It's sort of like an old-fashioned music appreciation book, except, the way that those books were written in the first half of the 20th century, it would give you examples of, what to listen for in music, and it would break music down into its constituent parts as the composer might define them, such as melody and harmony and rhythm and sonata form and so on. I'm sort of doing something similar, except I'm really doing it in terms of listening experiences. My thesis is that the listener has become a lot more powerful because of all this access that we have. So the chapters are, you know, loudness, density, speed, etc. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you start the book with repetition, which you call a smart psychological operation. How does it benignly manipulate the listener's attention within the song, repetition?
I think that when repetition in music is working really well, it's not just the same thing over and over, because that would drive us nuts. That would be a bad feeling. I think that what good repetition in music is a gradual change over a constant. In the book I write about how this happens in Steve Reich's piece Four Organs, and how it happens in a piece of music by the great band Chic, and songs by Rihanna and other things like that. The point of the book, obviously, is there's sort of a tacit argument against genre. So in each chapter, I'm trying to deal with as many kinds of far apart examples of music as possible.
Well, here's James Brown with Ain't It Funky Now.
Ain't it funky now? Ain't it funky now? Ain't it funky? Ain't it funky now?
What did James Brown understand about the power of repetition, Ben?
This is a long song, and in fact, it's so long that it has a part one and two. You know, when the single came out, it was half of it on side A and half of it on side B. What repetition can suggest in a song when it's really nice and feels good is a kind of a view of infinity. You know, it's an idea that, you know, wow, this could go on for a really long time. As long as I'm willing to give it, and it's changing slightly, as life does, you know. So, in that chapter about repetition and in others, I am trying to write about the sort of the psychological experience of listening to an effect like repetition and how it mirrors things in your own life, the way you move and the way you think about time, and so forth.
Not to be confused with repetition is songs that organize around a single note. And here we have the Ramones singing "I Want to Be Sedated." You call that guitar solo a good imitation of the states of non-thinking and non-feeling.
Right. Okay, so that's in a chapter about stubbornness and the single note. Mm. There's a bunch of examples of songs of all kinds that use that effect. This, like what you just heard in that little guitar solo there, the single note. The stubborn single note. Again, it's not like pure mechanical repetition. It's playing the same note over and over, but really getting the feel of it and giving you the feel of it. It sort of gives you a 360 degree view of a little place within the song. It situates you.
But it's not the same as sort of calming you or relaxing you. There's something about that single note over and over and over that creates kind of a state of being that's, I don't know, very intense in some ways.
That's right. Yeah. Like heightened awareness, I would say. That's right. It wakes you up. It keeps you on alert. And it's a thing that, it was so useful in that solo because, you know, that's a solo that you remember because it's weird. There's only one note, you know, so there's sort of like a weirdness appeal.
Yeah.
It's also very direct. I noticed that this is something that musicians do all across the board, you know, in bluegrass, Bill Monroe used to do that. In Cuban music, Arsenio Rodriguez, the great trace player, used to do these repeated single note, just one note over and over, or certain patterns repeated over and over. It's very, very powerful.
So this book is interesting because it suggests that could be a launch point, right? So are you saying if you like the Ramones, if you're drawn to that song, you could find songs that are completely different in terms of genre and even feel, but there might be something there to hook us?
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that we're surrounded by music all the time these days. You know, wherever we go, we hear it in movies. We hear it in station breaks on the radio. We hear it walking down the street. We hear it in stores, you know. And I think, actually, we're probably often hearing music that we don't know, that we're not familiar with, if we get around a little bit, you know. And especially if you go to neighborhoods that you're not that familiar with, or cities or countries, you will constantly be hearing music that you don't know. And I think that what I'm saying is that we can encounter some music that we don't know, and rather than blocking it out and saying, "Nah, that's not for me," we can seize on some aspect of it and say, okay, that reminds me of something I do know, and that connects to something I do know. And so that is also for me. That is about me as well. I think part of the job of a music critic, as I see it, is to make connections between things. Well, all right, a popular music critic. I'm dealing with a whole lot of different kinds of music. I think it's very useful to make connections between different kinds of music partially to show how things are actually fundamentally related, but also to show listeners that they can, you know, that they're good listeners, that the average person is probably a good listener. And all you need is a little bit of vocabulary to start connecting things. And that doesn't have to be musical vocabulary. And, you know, the things that I'm talking about in this book, they're not really musical vocabulary. Repetition and, you know, speed and density, so forth.
All right, let's get some speed here. This is Bud Powell with Salt Peanuts. Okay, I have to tell you, I really like that. It makes me feel like running around in a circle like a preschooler, which I don't know if that's the intention.
Right.
But in the right mood, that song feels great. And yet you say that speed, and I love this, is like a sweater on a dog. In music, it has no practical purpose.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, why are they hurrying? You know, like, what's the hurry? Where are they going so fast? Yeah, well, it's show, you know, to show you how fluent they are as improvisers, being able to improvise through the chord changes at that speed. So there's some sort of like peacockery going on there. But also just in a basic way, I think speed like that, you know, with that, that's probably around 360 beats per minute, is sort of like a game of chicken with the listener. It's like, we're hanging on. Can you hang on? You know, are you interested? Can you take it? you know, it's sort of like there's always sort of a tacit contract with the listener. You know, like, are you with me? Are you on the same page? Am I satisfying you? And using speed like that sort of pushes the limits of the contract.
It certainly is hard to ignore. It would be hard to have that song on in the background and not have it affect the pace of your day.
Yeah. Well, it makes you race, right? It makes your heart rate go up. I mean, when you think about it, music really is about physical motion, you know? I mean, that's often what it seems to be describing. So music is always about us in some way or other. And the way we move, and then, you know, on a more cerebral level, the way we think.
My guest is jazz and pop critic for The New York Times, Ben Ratliff. His new book is called Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
Try to sleep. but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
That was Hank Williams singing Your Cheating Heart. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ben Ratliff, who is pop and jazz critic for The New York Times and author of the new book Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I have to say, Ben, I love that you have a chapter on loudness, because there is a certain power to a song that comes at us loud. It's not just that we turn it up, it's that the artist clearly intended to sound loud.
Oh, sure. A lot of people have been saying that this book, certain chapters in this book, treat subjects in music that are often thought of as like negative things, you know, like loud, like repetition, for example. You know, I don't like that song, it's so repetitive. I don't know. Repetition is kind of great in music, don't you think? and loudness also strategically is amazing in music.
Let's listen to another example of a loud song. This is David Guetta and Sia's Titanium. People who just turned on the radio are thinking, what has happened to KERA? You know, those two songs don't sound anything like one another, and yet they both have this quality of really strong volume.
What, the Hank Williams?
The Hank Williams and the,
Did I link those in the book? I can't even
remember. I think they're both under Loudness, which I just thought was great because they're both great songs, but in really different ways, and yet they share this quality. And yet you wouldn't think, you know, to sort of put them together or discover Hank Williams if you love Sia necessarily.
Yeah. Well, they certainly both have intensity. And the production that David Guetta song with Sia... yeah, I mean, that uses loudness very strategically, kind of blitzing you with it, bordering on uncomfortable. And also that sound, it's sort of like retreating in pulsations as the kick drum seems to be pushing it away. It's that's a listening experience, you know. And again, back to the genesis of this book, I thought that it just, you know, I wanted to write a book that was about listening experiences, not a book so much about what the composer wants you to understand. Because it's through listening experiences that you can sort of get over genre. Genre sort of ceases to matter.
In your personal life, when you are not doing music for the New York Times or anybody else that you write for, do you use music to match your mood, or are you more likely to use it to change your mood or influence your mood?
Like it. Well, in the evening, I guess I would say in the evening, I tend to listen to more contemplative or quieter music, for sure. But for the rest of the day, anything, really. And I really like... rather than, like, for instance, I go running every morning and I listen to music when I do that. I'm usually in the car for some portion of the day, maybe half an hour. And so I think about, well, what am I going to listen to? I really like to listen to different kinds of music, radically different kinds of music in, say, a 45-minute stretch, because it sort of retrains my hearing. And it keeps me thinking. Certainly for running, it sort of keeps my speed up, you know, my pace up, to be able to think about, you know, like you listen to a slow piece of orchestral music, then you listen to a fast piece of, you know, hardcore or something. You just think about, okay, what am I to do with this music? How am I going to get around it? How do I interact with it? What's it all about? What expectations is it setting up for me? These are the thoughts that I love to have as a listener, and this is where I think listening becomes a really creative act. It's not a passive thing. It's a really creative act beyond just the fun of being able to do that when you're out running or whatever. Listening to music, I think, helps you grow as a person. It gives you, I think it influences what kind of person you are and how you move and, what kind of friendships you have. And in some cases, it teaches you foreign languages, you know.
When you speak like that, it makes me think about music education in schools, which doesn't really focus on these things, you know, and things may have changed since I was in school. But if you're not a music student, if you're just a regular student taking some music classes, you may be, you know, exposed to a few things to try to help you know the difference between jazz and classical music and spirituals. But you're not necessarily taught to use music as a way to interpret the world.
Right. Well, that's a good question. I don't know enough about how music is taught to children widely these days. I just don't know. I mean, I have kids who are late teenagers, and when they were very little, you know, we did a sort of music class, little kids music class, that was very much like the scenario you were describing earlier, where you run around in circles listening to fast music. But then, you know, and when I was a kid, I did have some music appreciation classes, which was, and I don't know how widely this is done anymore. It's probably not very much at all, where it was basically, you know, these are the great works of the Western musical canon. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, basically Bach to Brahms. So anyway, my book is not a canon. My book is not a narrowing down of works and saying, here are the great works you ought to know. These examples that I'm talking about, and there's a list of songs at the end of each chapter of the music that I've described, they're from all over the place. This book is about broadening your listening, not narrowing it down.
Okay, before we talk about density, let's listen to Outkast singing Rosa Parks. What makes that song such a good example of density in music?
Oh, it's just all those moving parts.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much to listen to there, layered things, rhythmic and melodic and just textural. And the chapter that I wrote about density deals with it in two different ways, both as just masses of little things like that and a sort of... the chapter is called Granite and Fog. It's like either you know, a whole bunch of masses of things, or granite, or density like fog can be dense, there's sort of an airiness, but there's a heavy atmosphere in the music, a dense, heavy atmosphere in the music, even if it's airy and not full of all those little moving parts like in the Outkast song.
You say that density can be about a quality of the space, which sort of relates to what you were just saying about fog.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. There can be density in music with lots of long, resonant tones. That sit a certain way in the recording or in the room. There can be density in a sort of spiritual way. I hear this in certain West African or Congolese music, especially for some reason, in the 1960s and 1970s. Rhythmically, it's very airy. It's not full of little popping layers and stuff like in that Outkast song. But it's so, it is so, this music is so dense in a way. It seems to imply like spirits in the room, you know, like we are doing music here as a way of life. This music suggests spirits who, you know, were here long before you got here and will be here long before you leave. That's a different kind of density.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jason in Gun Barrel City. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Excellent. I have a quick question about what you were talking about earlier regarding compression and loudness and the loudness wars and whatnot. And I just wanted to see if you could comment on the psychological aspect of pumping and spitting, as it's referred to in the industry, when you have something that's overly compressed, and how fatiguing that is to the ear and how that affects, you know, the song.
Yeah. Yeah, we weren't talking about compression per se, but certainly that Sia and David Guetta song is a perfect example of compression. Compression just means like there's not a huge dynamic range in the loudness. Basically, everything is loud in the song. Even the quiet parts, so-called, are loud. Well, it's it does fry your ears. Super compression like that. I find music that is mastered like that to be incredibly intense and actually very exciting for short periods of time. And then you're kind of done. I understand why the loudness wars, so-called, have happened. You know, it's wanting to break through in radio. It's wanting to. In a way, this has been going on for a long time. In the mid '60s, in country records, certain producers jacked up the sound of pedal steel guitars so they would like leap out of the radio. So I'm kind of fond of compressed loud music, but I just can't hang with it for that long, and I know that a lot of people feel the same way. About 10 minutes and I'm fried.
What is wasteful authority in music? I love that term.
There's a chapter in this book that deals with this thing that I'm calling wasteful authority, which is when the musician or the artist seems to have so much control, so much mastery over the situation that they seem to be implying like, yeah, I could do this all day. Sometimes it borders on, it sounds almost like laziness or not rising fully to the occasion. But still there's that sense of just like, I'm on this, I can do this, I can do this in my sleep. And it's a quality that I associate between various people, including Tommy Duncan from Bob Wills' Western Swing Band and Dean Martin. And this guy, Mark E. Smith, from the post-punk English group, The Fall.
Well, here's Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys.
The man will tell you about it, Tommy.
Keep knocking, but you can't come in.
What I say?
Keep knocking, but you can't come in.
Knock, knock.
Keep knocking, but you can't come in. Get your little let me be. You thought you had me on the rack.
Yeah.
And I'd be there when you got back.
Well.
But I'm running on another track. Guess you better let me be.
Tommy Duncan doing there that just sort of draws you in and keeps you hanging?
Sort of a slouchiness, you know. He's one of my favorite singers because he just doesn't sound like he's trying that hard. His command over his style is so great. And it's sort of like he uses a sort of medium ground, you know, medium loud to medium soft. I don't know. He seems like a real person. That's a whole other thing that I didn't write about very much in this book. But yeah, it's just that sense of like, he sounds almost as if he's not trying, but he is executing total mastery.
What do you mean when you say he seems like a regular person, like this could be happening in his backyard with a bunch of guys he's jamming with?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a spontaneous quality to his performances. But also, even as he's singing and seems to be happy, there's a certain sort of like almost disappointed feeling in his voice, kind of like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to get too excited because, as we all know, sometimes things go wrong. So there's not kind of that fake showbiz, like, yeah, everything's great. He's just a little more real in that way.
It is sort of the difference between, you know, you can go to like a giant, really perfectly orchestrated and choreographed stadium show, and then you can go to a smaller room somewhere. And sometimes that intimate experience that's not quite so polished will stick with you more.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I write about all kinds of music in the New York Times, and I have been doing that for 20 years. And a lot of the music that I write about is done in sort of intimate spaces. I have colleagues who maybe do more of the big stadium shows and, big moments than that. I've covered lots of jazz and lots of, you know, music from other countries and cultures and so on. And yeah, I'm used to being in small clubs with small audiences. And it's a very powerful thing.
Ben Ratliff is my guest. He's jazz and pop critic for the New York Times and author of a new book called Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times jazz and pop critic Ben Ratliff. His new book is called Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen to Music in an Age of Musical Plenty. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Ken on the line in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've got a comment leading to a question. And what I wanted to ask you about is counterpoint. How important counterpoint is, not just in popular music, but everything. And to try to explain it to your viewers, I was going to pick Manfred Mann's Blinded by the Light. And why is Manfred Mann's Blinded by the Light so much more important than Bruce Springsteen's version? Well, the answer is counterpoint. He takes the chorus, which is, of course, Blinded by the Light, revved up like a deuce, another runner of the night, and he lays it on top of some silicone sister with her manager, Mister, told me I got what it takes. And he puts the two together in a way that is sort of harmonically interdependent, but yet independent from everything else. So much of popular music uses this, from Brian Wilson to ABBA, some of the great, you know, works of the last 50 years.
Well, what do you think about that, Ben?
I want to ask him. What he thinks counterpoint does for the listener.
What do you think, Ken?
For me, it takes me to another world. It takes something that would be normally sort of pedestrian and uninteresting, like Blinded by the Light, and lifts it to another place.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's two trains running. At the same time, it's two drawings being made simultaneously. It's like, you know, like drawing with both your hands at the same time, in ways that such that the lines mirror each other or complement each other or react to each other. It's yes, it's an amazing thing. Counterpoint per se is not something I dealt with as a subject in the book, because I was coming more from the point of view of what are some things that are not actually musical terms per se, you know. But yeah, counterpoint is an amazing quality in music. Yeah.
I want to talk about this thing you call the perfect moment. Is this designation more subjective than any of the other qualities that you've written about here?
Yes.
What
and
is
in
it?
Fact, well, I would also say that there is a structure to this book, which is, you know, these 20 ways to listen to music, 20 different kinds of musical listening experiences. But the other structure of the book is that I start with things that are really there and measurable in the music, and that I would notice and you would notice. And by the end of the book, I'm writing about things that perhaps only I would notice. And that's the point. My 20 ways are not your 20 ways. I'm just suggesting ways to talk about music and ways to link different kinds of music together. So in the final chapter, which is about the perfect moment, I suggest moments in various songs where something about the real, like, hidden essence of the song just sort of comes out. And it's almost like the song blushes, you know, like it becomes intensely aware of itself and it reveals itself to you.
But that was long ago. Now you've forgotten, I know.
That's Frank Sinatra singing goodbye. I don't know if we captured your perfect moment within that song, Ben.
You did.
Okay.
I think you did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, when he says that was long ago, I believe that's the highest note in the song, mm-hmm. sort of a peak. And then all of a sudden everything sort of drains away. And the music around him is much quieter. And you sort of see this narrator for who he really is. You know, verging on pathetic. And he's, you know, he's going to move forward with his life because he doesn't really have a chance. So, I mean, inside an intensely dramatic song, that to me seems to be kind of like the great moment.
I feel a little guilty about the perfect moments within my favorite songs because I'm wanting to fast forward through the rest of the song to get to that place and not paying as much attention to the things that aren't so perfect.
Well, but isn't the experience of expectation sort of nice?
Yeah.
You know, like it carries you through. I mean, I think a lot of most music in a way, because it's moving forward, you know, and you can't stop it. It's just always running away from you. Has to some degree that feeling. It's creating a feeling of expectation. You know, really skillful songs create a ton of expectation. It's a ritual, isn't it? You listen to the whole thing waiting for that moment, and then it happens, and then you kind of ease away from it.
I think you and I are about the same age, which means maybe like me, you grew up listening to entire albums, even if mm-hmm. they were, you know, two halves of a cassette tape or something.
Sure.
That's something that people really don't do so much of anymore.
I think that's right. Yes. My kids, for example, don't listen to albums for the most part.
Right.
You know, most people these days will get one song at a time as they wish from YouTube often, or from Spotify or whatever. It's all about efficiency. You know, what do you want to listen to right now? And I think I'm not down on that, because I think that, you know, that is that's an authentic way to listen now. I think holding your phone up to your ear and listening to a song that way just with the music coming out of the tiny little hole in the phone, listening to one song is a totally authentic way to listen to music now. And I think you can have a great and deep and committed experience with that song that way. But yeah, in the old days, we listened to records in full because we felt that there was something that they were going to teach us over the long haul. And there was also a kind of physical aspect of putting it on the turntable and turning it over in the middle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it created a physical context for you to interact with the music. There are other ways now that we can interact with music. Like when you listen to a song on SoundCloud,
mm-hmm.
You can put little comments in, you know?
Right.
So like you're at 1 minute and 31 seconds into a song, you'll see somebody comments and goes like, ooh, you know? And I feel that's great too. That is a way of interacting with the song, that's what we want to do. We want to be inside it. We want it to reflect us and the way we think and move and feel.
How do you define a virtuoso?
You know, it's a word I seldom use in the newspaper because it's an absolute kind of term.
Right. There can only be so many, right?
Right, exactly. If you use it too much, then it's meaningless. But I think virtuosos, and I wrote about Sarah Vaughan and Art Tatum in this book, being two of them, among others, are people whose your fluency is just so great that it rolls out of you. And sometimes it's all about fluency. It's all about how strong your voice is, how easy this is for you. And it can be too much, you know, depending on how you feel about that sort of thing. So in the chapter about virtuosity, I kind of wrote about the pros and cons of it a little bit.
Well, let's listen here to Sarah Vaughan singing Time After Time.
So lucky to be loving you. So
there, Ben, like she's almost walking the line between making it sound really easy for her and letting you know that what she's doing is just about impossible for would-be imitators.
Yeah, there's something to that too. This, right, exactly. I'm the boss at this. I can do this better than you. Beware.
I don't know. I mean, virtuosos, great virtuosos, do things that aren't strictly necessary in a song. You know, they can sort of extend phrases, they're showing. They're just showing, endlessly. You know, that was an interesting little section because I felt like that was sort of slow and considered, and that wasn't the kind of like dazzle you. Knock you over the head, Sarah Vaughan. But she had different qualities. She shows up in the slowness chapter too. She was a great, great slow singer. You can't say, you know, Art Tatum was not a great slow musician that I'm aware of.
I was interested that you picked Jimi Hendrix for your chapter on improvisation, which we associate so much with a different form of music than Jimi Hendrix played. First of all, I want to listen to Machine Gun, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Do you think improvisation works as well for people who don't fully understand music and don't sort of recognize that that's what it is?
Yeah. You mean can the average person appreciate improvisation?
Right, who's not tried it, you know?
Totally. I think so. Yeah, because I think improvisation is about risk. It's about, you know, risk, doing something big and taking a risk. And it's also often about telling a story, you know? I mean, a lot of great improvisation has a narrative quality. That solo on Machine Gun by Jimi Hendrix and Band of Gypsies, which is such a, I mean, I don't even have words for that, for how great that is. I feel like it's on the top shelf. That connects in my mind with, and I lined this out a little bit in the book, with Body and Soul by Coleman Hawkins, and also a great solo by Eric Dolphy with Charles Mingus on the song Stormy Weather, where they're telling a story. You know, there's a real entrance and then the body of the thing and then an exit. And there's so many little things that happen along the way. And also there's sort of there's a buildup to a great moment of intensity that happens about two-thirds of the way through, and then it starts to tail off. So it has this, which is something that Wagner did also. There's like a rule of two-thirds in Wagner. So they have, like, these people know what they're doing. You know, there's a sense of classical form, and there's also a sense of, hello, I'm going to introduce myself. Let me get in your space. I'm going to do this for a while now. You know, are you with me? Can you hear me? I'm going to dazzle you, and then I'm going to elegantly, you know, take my leave.
If I had to summarize this book in just a few words for a friend, I would say it's a case for mindfulness in listening to music.
I'm glad. yeah, I mean, back to my point that I think listening is a creative act, not a passive one. And that... oh, I don't know. We have such agency now as listeners. We've got, you know, the book, the title of the book is sort of a joke, Every Song Ever, because we don't have every song ever. But it certainly can feel that way. And it's sort of like we've got this stuff now. I mean, we've really got it. It's easy to find. So what are we going to do with it? Are we just going to let it sit there? Or are we going to start, you know, connecting things? And... allowing ourselves to be broad listeners.
Ben Ratliff is a jazz and pop critic for the New York Times and author of the new book, Every Song Ever, 20 Ways to Listen in an Age of Musical Plenty. Ben, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thanks a lot.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today and help pulling all those music cuts from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Weddington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.